chaotic by the standards of these normally staid affairs. After giving the first of two speeches, Obama stood in a photo line in front of a neutral backdrop and had his picture taken with dozens of the people who had sponsored the event. Apparently, some of the Chinese had been scalping their tickets for this photo line. There was just one problem with this practice. To get past security, your name had to match the name on the ticket, so people started to be turned away. This led to shouts and shoving, and ultimately a fight broke out. So there we were, in a windowless room, wondering just how out of hand things could get. "Well," Obama said, "that's never happened before." I had skipped the first speech. "You have to see this," he told me, with amusement, taking a sip from his tea. "No one listened to a word I had to say." This was an attribute of Obama's that I'd found appealing from the beginning of his first run for the presidency, a capacity to step outside himself and observe the absurdity of his circumstances. I followed him into the ballroom where he was going to make his second speech. Bright yellow lights beamed from the ceiling, lending the nondescript curtain room a slightly futuristic vibe. As soon as Obama began talking, nearly the entire audience stood, turned their backs to him, and started taking selfies. There was an undercurrent of noise as people elbowed each other to try and get Obama, speaking at the podium, into the frame. Presumably, these people had paid to hear a former U.S. president, but their foremost intention had been to get that selfie. Obama dutifully plowed through a short set of remarks about globalization that nobody seemed to be listening to, an apt metaphor for the geopolitical moment. "If you ever write a novel about what it's like to be a former president," I told him as he walked off stage, "this has to be the opening scene." He laughed and, as he often does, connected this seemingly obscure event to a larger truth. "To Americans in 2017, he said, "the Chinese seem as Americans must have seemed to Europeans 100 years ago, the ill-mannered yet emerging new rich." Within that analogy was a harder-edged reality, that the crass Americans had displaced the more refined Europeans in much the same way that the Chinese were now poised to do to us. The previous night, we'd dined with Xi Jinping at an old imperial palace in Beijing. Lanterns lit winding pathways amid manicured gardens. At a large round table, Xi hosted us for a multi-course meal, punctuated with occasional shots of Chinese liquor. Xi was, as usual, calm and assured. He'd recently presided over a Chinese Politburo meeting, where he'd taken yet another step toward consolidating his power. The conversation moved easily over a mix of geopolitical issues, Chinese economic plans, and reminiscence. Both leaders took care to only walk up to the edge of addressing the Trump in the room. When the dinner was over, as I watched Obama introduce each of his staffers to Xi, it occurred to me that I was looking at the most powerful man in the world, who was not, for the first time in a long time, an American president. And Xi had none of the sense of defensiveness and grievance that characterized interactions with Putin. This was a guy who was totally comfortable sitting at the top of the pyramid, methodically asserting his power over more than 1 billion people, refining a totalitarian system, waiting out, strong-arming, or steamrolling the next obstacle in front of him. China is different from nations like Hungary and Russia because it never made any pretense of embracing liberal democracy at the end of the Cold War. And unlike Hungary or Russia, China has the size, wealth, and self-confidence to eclipse the light of liberal democracy that has been something of a North Star since the end of World War II. For most of the last few 100 years, the center of geopolitical gravity was in Europe, home to the Enlightenment, the emergence of nation-states, the rise of empires, the catastrophe of world wars, the Cold War competition between the American and Russian superpowers. China was on the periphery of this world, a great civilization turned into a divided and partially colonized country, a Japanese-conquered member of the World War II Allies, an impoverished communist regime that helped determine the outcome of the Cold War by shifting its weight slightly away from the Soviet Union and toward the United States. In the span of just 30 years, the center of gravity has shifted. Today, Viktor Orban's Hungary represents the emerging brand of nationalist authoritarianism that has infected the West in the wake of globalization's failures. Vladimir Putin's Russia represents the disruption of the post-World War II global order of international laws, norms, and institutions through a return to an old and aggressive definition of national security and sovereignty. Xi Jinping's China represents the emerging model of capitalism blended with techno-totalitarianism that could be our future, as it is taking hold on nearly every continent. Far from the periphery, Beijing could become the new center of global events. The United States made this possible. Since the end of the Cold War, we've developed a symbiotic relationship with the Chinese. Our businesses eagerly decamped to China to make cheap goods that they could then sell back to Americans hungry for ever-improving standards of living. It's almost impossible to imagine an American household that doesn't have something in it that was made in China, even as much of the wealth created through this process was accumulated by the very few Americans who sat at the top of our own economic pyramid, the people who ran companies, traded stocks, held portfolios, and repeatedly had their taxes cut. As the Chinese became richer, they became not just a factory but a market for American businesses, a vast frontier of emerging wealth to buy cars, computers, software, semiconductors, soybeans, sneakers, Starbucks coffee, Hollywood movies, NBA basketball, and more than $1 trillion worth of U.S. debt. It was no secret that as this process unfolded, the Chinese were also stealing American technologies and intellectual property, using them first to catch up with us and then to pull ahead of us in the new frontiers of artificial intelligence that will increasingly shape life on Earth. At every turn, the profit motive and economic interdependence between our countries ensured the concerns over democratic values would be subordinate to other interests. The U.S. government always had higher priorities. The American moguls, who served as thought leaders on China and gatekeepers to the Chinese market, men like Henry Kissinger, Hank Paulson, Steve Schwarzman, and Mike Bloomberg, really had only one idea to offer. Do what the Chinese want, and you can make money there. U.S. businesses acquiesced to the self-censorship that comes with operating in China. U.S. venture capital helped build the Chinese tech sector that was perfecting methods of surveillance. U.S. popular culture gradually expunged the democratic themes that would make a movie, show, or game less welcome in the Chinese market. The United States and China had made a series of historic decisions over the last half century to draw closer together. But the values America purports to stand for in the world were never a part of those decisions. It's therefore no surprise that China has become more like America in apolitical spheres, the way they've plugged into the grid of the global economy, the pollution they spew into the atmosphere, the pop culture they consume, the technology-driven nature of life in the 21st century. Think of American capitalism and culture devoid of liberal values and democratic politics, and you'll get something approximating the Chinese Communist Party. But in recent years, the balance has also shifted. It is now America that is becoming more like China, a place of growing economic inequality, grievance-based nationalism, vast data collection, and creeping authoritarianism. The shifting position of our two nations has been on stark display through the ordeal of COVID-19, which spread from the Chinese city of Wuhan in part because the first instinct of a controlling Chinese government was to suppress the news about its lethality and risk of contagion. When COVID did inevitably spread, China was able to move its massive ship of state quickly to lock down whole cities and control the virus, while an America governed by a disinterested authoritarian regime proved incapable of any collective action. While China made a show of its rising influence within institutions like the World Health Organization, the United States made a show of withdrawing from the WHO and performed so incompetently that Americans were barred from entry by many countries around the world. American politics became characterized by a paranoid and sometimes bipartisan demagoguery about a rising China that feels one step behind the times. China isn't rising, it has risen. In 1990, the U.S. economy dwarfed China's, and our political model was rapidly ascendant all across the world. How did things change so dramatically? 15. The outlier. I first met Bao Pu in a coffee shop in Hong Kong after months of protest had dominated the life of the city. In his early 50s, he was youthful in appearance and in the certainty of his statements, though his views were tinged with fatalism. He had the conflicted air of a man who doesn't trust people easily but has a lot to say. "You don't understand China by looking at the present," he would continually insist through our conversations. "You have to understand the history." "The most significant question," he told me, "is what can explain China as an outlier compared to the rest of the world after the Cold War?" Over the course of our time together, he tried to answer that question. In 1989, Bao Pu was a senior at university. He remembered the 1980s as a time of relative openness, at least for young people coming of age in China's major cities. Reading translated works was fashionable, but only among certain people, better educated people. China had only recently lived through the Cultural Revolution, Mao Zedong's fanatical effort to eliminate counter-revolutionary elements, which had purged intellectuals and killed millions of people over the course of a decade, ending around Mao's death in 1976. "After the Cultural Revolution, the mood was for change," Bao told me. "And so ideas were contested within the party apparatus, as well as within the society at large among the educated urban elites. There were debates back and forth that reflected the 80s, the competition of two ideas focusing basically on one issue. The issue was whether the Communist Party could actually use capitalist means to develop its economy, because Mao's economic model had failed." There was little need for debate about the failure of Mao's economic model. A 1950s effort to modernize China's economy, the so-called Great Leap Forward, intended to grow China's economy to the size of Great Britain's, had instead initiated the Great Famine that killed tens of millions of Chinese by the early 1960s. That horror had been followed by the Cultural Revolution. After Mao's death in 1976, China's new leader, Deng Xiaoping, opened up China's economy to capitalism, shaping the world in which Bao Pu would come of age. Through the 1980s, as China began to plug into the grid of global capitalism, the nascent debates described by Bao Pu addressed China's political model, a different version of debates happening across the communist bloc. In Hungary, popular frustration with Soviet-backed communism was making sweeping change inevitable. In Russia, Mikhail Gorbachev was testing whether economic and political reform could be controlled, even as Soviet elites were beginning to prepare for a post-Soviet future. In China, there wasn't a similar tipping point that had ripened in the society. But there was a sense that the leadership would soon face a choice about whether China's economic opening should be accompanied by political reforms, freedom of speech, freedom of the press, efforts to combat corruption, and ultimately a multi-party system rooted in democratic accountability. In April 1989, Chinese student protests began in Beijing after the heart attack and death of Hu Yaobang, a reformist who had recently been ousted from his position as General Secretary of the Communist Party. The largely student-driven movement drew crowds that swelled to a million people around Tiananmen Square. Bao Pu was one of them. 1989 was an accident, he told me, with little bravado, because the timing was triggered by someone's unexpected death. So it's not like society actually reached this boiling point and then the last straw happened. Instead, it represented the moment when the elite debate that had been taking place moved into the streets of the capital city. It spilled over from the party's internal dispute to the society. Gorbachev was scheduled to visit Beijing that May. With the spotlight on that visit, Deng's hands were tied. He had worked to repair relations between the Soviet and Chinese Communist parties, which had suffered over the last three decades. That initiative was set to culminate in the visit of the reformist Gorbachev, and Deng didn't want to distract from that achievement. In Deng Xiaoping's mind, Bao told me, "Mao parted with the Soviet Communists. I'm the one who brought the two big communist parties together. This is my historical accomplishment." So because of that timing constraint, Deng Xiaoping had to wait until May 18, after Gorbachev left Beijing, to deal with the student protests. That allowed for a whole month of occupying Tiananmen, giving the illusion that the Communist Party had no power to contain the protests. Bao paused slightly. But they had all the power. In this telling, Tiananmen is both a product of history and an accident of history. It was a product because younger people, like some of the elite cadre of the Chinese Communist Party and students across the Communist bloc, were questioning the failure of the Communist model throughout the 1980s. It was an accident because the protests started after the untimely death of a reformer and endured for weeks because of the impending visit of the reformist leader of the Soviet Union. At the time, Bao Pu's father was a close aide to Zhao Ziyang, the general secretary of the Communist Party. The two of them wanted to have a dialogue with the students, to recognize the legitimacy of their concerns, to accept that China should move in a reformist direction. Deng Xiaoping had different ideas. Basically, Deng believed that politically they could not open up, Bao said. Deng himself had experience with this kind of debate. Decades earlier, Nikita Khrushchev had written a secret report criticizing Stalin and his more repressive tactics, setting in motion the Soviet Union's distancing itself from Stalinism and ultimately embracing détente with the United States. The man who delivered Khrushchev's secret report to Mao was Deng. Mao saw the report as a profound threat to his own absolute power and legacy. That analysis, in turn, helped precipitate the very breach between the Soviet and Chinese Communist parties that Deng was mending in 1989. Deng learned from Mao, Bao told me, how Mao assessed the secret report that criticized Stalin and then the Hungarian and Polish uprisings. This experience made Deng inclined to use the army to crack down on mass movements. He was ready to use hard power. He did use it. Within a couple of weeks of Gorbachev's departure, a quarter of a million troops were brought into Beijing to crack down on the students. Tanks rolled into Tiananmen Square. Live fire was used against the students. Thousands were killed. Bao Pu watched as protesters were shot down around him. His father was imprisoned and then placed under surveillance in Beijing. It was a pivotal moment in Bao Pu's life. He ultimately came to the United States, became a U.S. citizen, and then settled in Hong Kong in the early 2000s, where he started an independent publishing company with his wife. He carved out a niche publishing histories that challenged the Chinese Communist Party's version of events. Secret papers about the Tiananmen crackdown. Memoirs by reformist members of the party. Books that probed lurid and corrupt corners of the party. I remember, growing up at the time of Tiananmen and the years after, seeing Deng Xiaoping as a small, friendly-looking old man who opened up China's economy to Coca-Cola and factories that made cheap American products. In reality, he'd spent decades as one of Mao's enforcers, presiding over the killing and starvation of hundreds of thousands of people long before 1989. History was on the move at the outset of the 1990s. Gorbachev was opening up the Soviet political system. Eastern European countries like Hungary democratized. Soviet republics like Ukraine declared independence. America distanced itself from autocratic right-wing allies who had formed a bulwark against communism around the world. Democracy bloomed in Latin America and in parts of Africa and Southeast Asia. Nelson Mandela walked out of prison. The Dalai Lama was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. China opened up its economy, but not its political system. The Communist Party, Bao Pu said, they see the outcome of the Cold War. And so now they unanimously conclude that if we don't actually strengthen party control, we're finished, just like the Soviet communists. I expected Bao Pu to be a recognizable advocate, the oppositionist who speaks the language of Western democracy. But despite his antipathy for the Communist Party, he also rejected the frame of the 20th century debates, West versus East, capitalism versus communism, democracy versus the dictators, as a Western construct. Like Navalny, he has been shaped by his own country and experience. The Communist Party, he argued, is built on the Western model that claims an ideology to create a social program. And when it doesn't work, they lie. In this telling, the Chinese Communist Party is rooted in the Western idea of Marxism imposed on an ancient civilization. As the 90s dawned and the Soviet Union died, Bao said, the party recognized it needed to change course. After 1992, they found that the rest of the world was operating under a market economy. So now, if we control money, we control everything. It was just a practical choice. And so they went shopping for another Western idea available to the party, capitalism in place of Marxism, as a form of social and political control. That's the choice the Chinese Communist Party made. By opening up, they could accumulate the money that was power in the post-Cold War world. But they needed other forms of legitimacy. They needed a story to tell about who they were and why they were in charge. So they leaned harder on nationalism, a mix of history and culture, Chinese grievances, and supremacy. The Cold War was all about the ideological struggle, Bao Pu said. But that has gone out of fashion. The 21st century is about identity. Identity is something that you cannot put into a framework, but that's where the emotion is. And that identity, of course, is defined by both who you are and who you are against. The driving force, Bao Pu told me, is the rise of a Chinese identity versus the West, versus Japan. So this is the major issue. The modern Chinese identity is the key to understanding every present-day China issue on the world stage. Bao Pu went through his own list. China's humiliations at the hands of Western powers in the 19th century. China's subjugation by Japan during World War II. The American abandonment of the Chinese Republic to Mao's advancing armies in the war's aftermath. To Bao, these veins of humiliation, betrayal, and fear of chaos run deep through the Chinese body politic, and the party has proved capable of tapping them. Throughout the 1990s and 2000s, the party dialed up anti-Western and anti-Japanese themes in official media, stirring up lingering resentments over Western colonization and Japanese atrocities. They scrubbed the school curriculum of the Western materials that Bao Pu recalled from the 1980s. They buried the historical memory of Mao's catastrophic mistakes and rehabilitated Confucius, the preeminent ancient Chinese philosopher whose thought had been sidelined under Mao, as a justification for a society focused on collective effort over individual rights. Confucius was rejected in the 20th century, Bao told me. They trashed Confucius to the point of no return, but the ideology turned out to be bankrupt, and they were trapped in their own empty framework. Trapped, that is, by an embrace of Marxism, which could never deliver results in China. Once they were freed from this framework, the Chinese Communist Party thrived as never before. The economy took off and grew at an unprecedented clip, generating its own brand of legitimacy. For most people who still remember the poverty of the 20th century, Bao Pu said, life is pretty good now. Of course, they have to put up with a lot of bullshit in their daily lives when they clash with the authorities, but overall, for most people, living standards have improved dramatically. They have wealth and a certain amount of power. They see that the Chinese government projects a certain kind of image, that they already have world influence. It's all trying to feed a sense of pride, and nothing but that. Having wealth and power has always been the goal of China in the modern era. The rise in Chinese living standards dwarfed the wealth created in Russia by the spike in oil revenues in the 2000s. Hundreds of millions of people were lifted out of poverty, one of the great leaps forward for humanity in recent history. This was made possible by the melding of American capitalism with Chinese governance. The global economy we built, the trade arrangements that we welcomed China into, the top-down system that enabled massive changes in compulsory work to satiate the consumer demand in the West. And it was buttressed by the construction of a new Chinese nationalism, designed in opposition to the very Western countries that were buying all of those Chinese-made goods. It seems obvious, in retrospect, that a blend of state-controlled prosperity and nationalist fervor could allow the Chinese Communist Party to navigate the turn of the century. But as an outsider, an American comfortable with my status in the world, I found it easy, not to feel threatened by a process that was opaque to me, not to ask too many questions about the assumptions underpinning it. I remember a familiar refrain that Xi Jinping would use in conversations with Obama, that Confucian values spoke to the Chinese people's need to belong to a broader collective, whereas American society was built around the individual. It sounded interesting, and unlike Putin's aggressive brand of Russian nationalism, Xi seemed to truly believe it, without wanting to impose it on you. Of course, there was something self-justifying in the story. In the same way that American politicians can find justification for just about anything they want in the writings of our founding fathers, while ignoring all the disturbing parts, Xi could simultaneously extol Confucian values while embracing Mao, who suppressed Confucian thought. To Bao Pu, the party's co-opting of Confucianism is offensive. Chinese culture, he told me, was anchored in a civilization distinct from the short-term interests of the party. There's a colossal force still there because of a tradition that has existed for 2,000 years, and it's not been forgotten. The party just use it as window dressing to give the impression that they represent Chineseness. But the Communist Party, being a Leninist party, has nothing to do with Chinese civilization. Confucius, for instance, featured prominently at the 2008 Olympic Games in Beijing, meant to herald China's emergence on the world stage. This, to Bao Pu, was emblematic of a hijacking of traditional Chinese identity for crude political ends. He cited a soaring statue of Confucius that was erected around the games. Who built that kind of statue? It was totally fascist in style. It really had nothing to do with Confucianism. Modern Chinese identity is more complex. It arose with the challenge of the West, but it has deeper roots in its culture and is really a colossal force. Unfortunately, the Communist Party is the only one in the position to use that force, and it does so for its own benefit. I considered America's own debates around our 250 years of independence. We have existed as a country for a fraction of China's history, with a population that is a fraction of China's. Could, as Bao suggests, a more ancient Chinese identity still be a living force among the people despite Mao's systematic destruction of traditional Chinese society over several decades? One irony of China's ascendance is that achieving Mao's vision of a rising China depended upon the party's abandoning a number of Mao's convictions. Communism, worldwide revolution, self-sufficiency. But not the most important one. The Chinese Communist Party must rule and is the sole arbiter of Chinese identity. It is an identity that Bao Pu has spent a lot of time thinking about, and his resentment of the party leadership is rooted partly in the way that he believes it has been repeatedly westernized. Communism, capitalism, and, finally, totalitarianism. To Bao Pu, China's more enduring culture allows for a greater degree of self-criticism and evolution than the rigid system that has hardened in the 21st century, even as he glosses over China's own history of authoritarian control. The Chinese civilization offers an alternative way of thinking about ideology, he said. Western culture traditionally tended to distinguish between good and evil in absolute terms, defining a clear line. The Chinese never think that way. Instead, Confucius tradition focuses on personal virtue. This focus would compel leaders to admit error and evolve, the opposite of how the Chinese Communist Party operates. As a ruler, you are supposed to perfect your virtue. When you fail, you hold yourself accountable. The ideal leader in the Confucius tradition would not try to put total control over society. Like Bao Pu, Ching Chong was shaped by Tiananmen as a young journalist reporting on the protests. In the ensuing decades, he reported on and experienced how the Communist Party strengthened its control over society. A friend took me to see him in Hong Kong, insisting that he could describe this matter of how Chinese nationalism has been part of the party's effort to assert control. I sat across the table as he sipped tea and nibbled on snacks. Like an oracle, he was accustomed to being listened to. In his younger days, he had worked for the Communist Party's media on the mainland. When I asked when he left that job, he said, June 4th, 1989, the peak of the Tiananmen crackdown. His post-Tiananmen career took him to the Straits Times, a Singapore-based newspaper. In the 2000s, he was imprisoned for 1,000 days by the Chinese for publishing state secrets, a severe charge used to intimidate or punish journalists who publish things the government doesn't like. In prison, he was subjected to brutal interrogation and more than 100 days in solitary confinement, with no windows, no light, and no idea what was going to happen to him. Ching Chong spoke with certainty about enormous questions and events, perhaps shaped by his experience of oppression. As if relaying a secret source of knowledge, he told me that the dividing line in terms of the introduction of Chinese nationalism and identity politics was a 1993 party document on China's response to the collapse of the Soviet Union. In that document, Ching told me, it said that after the Soviet collapse, Marxism-Leninism no longer has a market in China, so we should return to Chinese nationalism and promote Chinese culture. Before that, the Chinese Communist Party was wedded to the Soviet ideology of a global Marxist revolution that knew no borders. As Bao Pu had told me, with the collapse of the USSR, that was no longer going to work. So they turned to traditional culture, Ching Chong told me. They turned to nationalism. The propaganda department began to produce documents on promoting patriotism and nationalism. As this nationalism emerged over the last three decades, the memory of Tiananmen was whitewashed from history. The events of those days are not taught in schools. Internet searches related to the protests are restricted. Those who show interest in the topic could end up, as Ching Chong did, detained with no knowledge of what's going to happen to them. For the broader population, these more contested aspects of politics can disappear from view. I asked a Chinese acquaintance who was born around the time of the Tiananmen protest what her generation's schooling had been on the subject. Most people of my generation don't know that it happened, she told me. Or people who know don't really know what happened. How many people were killed? What it was about? 16. The Chinese Dream. In 2008, China hosted the Olympic Games in Beijing. As the number 8 is associated with prosperity in Chinese culture, the opening ceremony was on August 8th, 8-8-2008. It cost over $100 million and involved more than 15,000 performers. Over the span of 4 hours, the sprawling story of Chinese culture was told, from the terracotta warriors up to the marvels of postmodern technology. There was nothing subtle about it. The Chinese Communist Party was announcing China's ascent in the community of nations, drawing on the legitimacy of China's great civilization. Weather-altering technology ensured that the polluted skies were clear and it didn't rain. The Olympic torch was lit by a young Chinese gymnast who was made to appear to fly through the air. The spectacle was televised to an audience of billions. One wonders how a young person anywhere in the world could watch it and not think they were looking at the future. George W. Bush represented the United States in the stadium, a diminished man nearing the end of his tenure. The Iraq War was grinding into its sixth year. While Bush and the Republican Party were celebrating the results of the surge, a relatively small increase in the number of U.S. forces fighting across a relatively small country in the Middle East, as some defining moment of national greatness, China was doing this. The day before the opening ceremony, Russia invaded Georgia. The American-led order was fraying at the seams. My British friend in Singapore, the one who described the elongated reason cycle, recalled to me the moment when he believes the seams finally popped. It was a few weeks after the Beijing Olympics, when Alan Greenspan testified before Congress as the American financial system was melting down. Here was the man who presided over the massive economic growth in the two decades after the end of the Cold War, the maestro who was the invisible hand behind the Federal Reserve for much of that time, the steady, competent force who could be depended upon in financial capitals around the world, even when American politics resembled a playground of dysfunction. Even the Chinese implicitly accepted the premise that they had to defer to Americans of Greenspan's stature on the basic operation of the global financial system. During his testimony, Greenspan was asked, in essence, how did this happen? "I have found a flaw," Greenspan responded, referring to his basic worldview. "I don't know how significant or permanent it is, but I have been very distressed by that fact." "Bam," my friend said, describing the moment. "Shivers down the spine moment. That was the intellectual gunshot that was heard very loudly in Asia." He called it a hinge of history. Here was perhaps the most prominent embodiment of the American-led global economy acknowledging that the whole system was flawed. "I made a mistake," Greenspan went on, "in presuming that the self-interests of organizations, specifically banks and others, were such that they were best capable of protecting their own shareholders and their equity in the firms." The same global audience that marveled at the images of an ascendant superpower during the opening ceremonies in Beijing now felt their livelihoods endangered by that flaw at the heart of the global economy. People who had tacitly accepted the consensus of American-led globalization now saw both its failure and its potential replacement. The emergence of a Beijing consensus directly challenged the Washington consensus, Ching Chong told me. The financial meltdown showed clearly that it is the greed of those capitalists that brought a lot of problems to a lot of people. That was the time that people saw the failure of the American model versus the success of Chinese authoritarianism. A year later, in the fall of 2009, I traveled to China for Barack Obama's first visit to that country. All that year, Obama had gone to international summits, trying to rescue the American and global economy, in part by asking the Chinese to stimulate demand to replace American spending that had disappeared. In other words, by having Chinese people buy more stuff and shift toward a more consumer-based economy. Obama had leveraged his political capital and the fear of a global depression to get enough grudging nations to do their share. But no one was going to erase the memory of what America had done. The reckless deregulation of the American economy from the 1980s onward, the yawning chasm of inequality, the unaffordable mortgages urged on homeowners by banks that should have known better. By the time we got to Shanghai, the worst of the crisis was behind us. To penetrate the veneer of officialdom that clouds any engagement with the party leadership, we had a youth town hall event scheduled. We anticipated Chinese efforts to control the event, so we made a plan with the U.S. ambassador, John Huntsman. If the Chinese students seemed to be asking questions that were either fed to them by the authorities or self-censored to avoid sensitive topics, Huntsman would ask a question that had been submitted to the embassy's website. I drafted remarks for Obama that made the case for democratic values. "These freedoms of expression and worship, of access to information and political participation, we believe are universal rights," he said. "They should be available to all people, including ethnic and religious minorities, whether they are in the United States, China, or any nation." Then the questions came, and they were clearly designed to avoid certain subjects. "Shanghai will hold the World Exposition next year. Will you bring your family to visit the expo?" In Confucius's books, there is a great saying that harmony is good, but also we uphold differences. What would you do to respect the different cultures and histories of other countries? In your opinion, what's the main reason that you were honored with the Nobel Prize for Peace? It was hard to imagine that these were really the most pressing concerns of the young people in the audience. Most Chinese would never hear the words Obama said about democracy, but they would see the pictures of a charismatic American president and smiling Chinese students, heirs of the brave new world. In a way, the same thing has happened to countless American brands whose allure has been repackaged for a Chinese audience, stripped of any trace of democracy. Huntsman jumped in with a question that had been submitted to the embassy. "In a country with 350 million internet users and 60 million bloggers, do you know of the firewall? And second, should we be able to use Twitter freely?" Obama responded with a long answer about the importance of a free and open internet, access to the latest technologies, and freedom of speech and thought in general. The audience sat passively. The so-called Great Firewall, referred to in the question, was China's nascent effort to build the first distinct national internet. At first, undesirable foreign websites were banned. Twitter, Facebook, YouTube. Thousands of search terms were off limits. Things that were too dangerous for people to learn about, like the Tiananmen protest. The internet didn't provide all of human knowledge to all human beings after all. It was selective, like any human endeavor. The firewall was the Chinese government's response to one of the only remaining vulnerabilities for the party. In the early 2000s, young Chinese lived within a strange duality. People consumed the latest popular culture from around the world while being taught to distrust the individual liberty that enabled the creativity that produced comic book worlds, Beyoncé, and the NBA. The younger Chinese I talked to remembered an emerging discourse through the 2000s about political issues, particularly on tens of millions of microblogs, a version of the opening that Bao Pu had experienced in classrooms in the 1980s. There were debates about corruption and mismanagement, particularly at the local level, and growing activism around a more equitable rule of law. By the time we went to Shanghai, the party had decided that this trend was unacceptable. They also had no interest in listening to Americans lecture them about their internal affairs, particularly as Americans were asking for China's help in getting out of the financial crisis of their own making. By 2011, it had become fashionable to think that social media was the virus that would prove untreatable by authoritarian regimes. In the Arab Spring, mass mobilization fueled by social media toppled dictators across the Middle East, in Tunisia, Egypt, Libya, and Yemen. But the Communist Party saw that social media wasn't simply a threat. It could be controlled with the right firewall, and it was also a nearly ideal tool for surveillance and disinformation. Within China's Golden Shield program, the party monitored internet activity within China and blocked more sensitive keywords from internet users. Emerging Chinese tech companies were made to understand that their own growth depended upon strict regulation of political content. An untold number of Chinese government cyber police agents patrolled social media for subversion, while paid propagandists and, as Maria Stepanova would say, voluntary supporters filled it with messages lauding the party or denigrating its opponents. The China that had been emboldened around 2008 was unabashed in cultivating its own version of globalization, one that made use of technological progress in open markets while turning those tools against the freedom of the Chinese people. Then, China found the right leader for its moment of ascendance, the man who would take the next step in pursuit of the Chinese dream. Xi Jinping is the son of a member of the Chinese Communist Party's founding generation. When he was a teenager, his father was purged in the run-up to the Cultural Revolution. At the age of 15, Xi himself was sent to the countryside for a dose of hard labor. Instead of turning him away from the party, the experience instilled in him a fervent desire to join and rise through the ranks. It foreshadowed a certain aspect of Xi's character, one that recalled the line from V.S. Naipaul that Obama and I recited to each other when faced with the rougher edges of life and power. The world is what it is. Men who are nothing, who allow themselves to be nothing, have no place in it. Xi muscled his way up to the top of China's leadership pyramid, the heir apparent to Hu Jintao. He was an unusually large personality for a Chinese politician, married to a popular singer. Upon taking power in 2013, Xi introduced the concept of the Chinese dream, which spoke to a more showy and ambitious style than that of Hu, a mild-mannered man devoid of charisma who never broke from carefully prepared talking points in his meetings with Obama. Xi reportedly introduced the slogan at a private meeting of the party faithful at a museum exhibit focused on China's historical suffering at the hands of Western powers. "We must make persistent efforts," Xi said in a speech in March 2013, "press ahead with indomitable will, continue to push forward the great cause of socialism with Chinese characteristics, and strive to achieve the Chinese dream of great rejuvenation of the Chinese nation." Whereas past Chinese leaders like Deng Xiaoping had talked about the need to hide your capabilities, bide your time, Xi was casting off that sense of restraint. In an echo of the goals of Mao's Great Leap Forward, the Chinese dream involved China achieving the two 100s, a moderately well-off society by 2020, the 100th anniversary of the party, and a fully developed nation by 2049, the 100th anniversary of the People's Republic. The Chinese dream was the subject of a relentless nationalist propaganda campaign that also harked back to the days of Mao, complete with songs and dances. Xi launched a massive anti-corruption campaign, which simultaneously acknowledged the public's frustration with rampant corruption and served as a useful tool for Xi to sideline potential opponents. Factory owners could use the initiative to justify endless hours for their workers, who were called upon to produce the goods that would make China a great nation, and factory owners rich. And Xi promoted a cult of personality that emphasized his own charisma instead of just putting himself forward as the leader of the party. Students were forced to study his writings, party members recited his sayings, and television cast him as the star in China's story of ascent. I first met Xi in June 2013 at a summit at Sunnylands, a golf resort and retreat in Palm Springs, California, that were called a faded American glory and had been a favorite of presidents like Nixon and Reagan. I liked Xi from the perspective of a staffer who sits in meetings and doesn't talk. He had a personality. He broke from his talking points, and he brought a bottle of strong Chinese spirits to his dinner with Obama to break the ice. His large frame and protruding waistline drew a contrast with Hu's tendency to recede into his entourage. It suggested a man at ease in his skin and pleased with his power. There was also something ominous, though. Whereas past Chinese leaders spoke about China's core interests, a euphemism for interests that would never be compromised and could lead to conflict, with respect to issues like Tibet and Taiwan, Xi's definition was broader and included the entire South China Sea, maritime borders that absurdly snaked around the coastlines of several Southeast Asian nations and encompassed vast natural resources. Sizing up Xi's ambition, Obama set to work getting him focused on climate change as an issue on which Xi could demonstrate global leadership by dealing with the air pollution that was becoming a more dangerous phenomenon in China. If Xi took aggressive action on climate, Obama reasoned, he could differentiate himself from China's past leaders while unlocking the potential to reach an ambitious global climate change agreement, what became the Paris Agreement. In the first term, we needed China's help to save the global economy. In the second, we needed China's help to save the planet. To address China's more assertive approach in Asia, Obama accelerated an effort to consolidate a bloc of countries committed to a set of rules and norms for commerce that could be translated into geopolitics through the Trans-Pacific Partnership, TPP, a trade agreement that included traditional U.S. allies, as well as nations like Vietnam and Malaysia, who were threatened by China's claim to the South China Sea. A Vietnamese official once pointed out the importance of TPP to me as a signal of America's presence in Asia. "We have hated the Chinese for 1,000 years, but they are right here," he said, pointing to China's border with Vietnam. "They are going to be here. The question is, are you?" Obama had some success in appealing to Xi's ambitions while trying to shape how they evolved. The Chinese government stepped up its efforts on climate, and it was helpful on a handful of other foreign policy issues, from North Korea sanctions to the Iran nuclear deal. But Xi's heavy hand also became more apparent. The nationalism within Chinese media increased. In 2013, 7 subjects were deemed off-limits for the Chinese classroom: universal values, freedom of the press, independent civil society, civil rights, elite cronyism, judicial independence, and the past mistakes of the Chinese Communist Party. Official surveillance, harassment, and detentions increased, not just for dissidents, but also for lawyers, minority groups, Christians, journalists, and activists of various stripes. Efforts to control the U.S. media in China increased, and the Chinese government revoked visas from reporters working on stories about corruption and repression. The theft of intellectual property from American companies persisted despite our protests. Time and again, Xi echoed Deng's private conclusion about the collapse of the Soviet Union in his words and deeds: "Don't show any weakness, any compromise, or any concession to those who press for change that could affect the party's control, After Trump's election and swift withdrawal from TPP and any recognizable form of U.S. leadership, Xi's ambitions accelerated. He started talking about the need to build a military that could fight and win wars. His Made in China 2025 initiative focused on ensuring China's indigenous capacity and technological supremacy as American investment in research and development was falling. Chinese influence in nearly every part of the world increased, along with the heavy-handed tactics of Chinese diplomats. Xi did away with term limits, establishing himself as China's unrivaled leader for as long as he wants. To my British friend, the meaning of the Chinese dream is simple and rooted in that collapse of confidence in the American model in 2008. I think what it means, he told me, is not the American dream. This view fits neatly into the story that the Chinese Communist Party had been telling its people about the reemergence of China following the humiliations and chaos of the 20th century, their new identity as citizens of the next superpower. My friend summarized it. Mao was stand up, then Deng was get rich, and now Xi is become strong. Technology is central to the model that Xi and the party are building, with consequences that could ripple across the entire world. With the development of artificial intelligence, the capacity to make use of the vast amount of data available to an authoritarian government is accelerating exponentially. Just as the United States helped create the prosperity that enabled the party's control, U.S. technology has been copied, repurposed, and enhanced to secure that control, sometimes with investments from U.S. venture capital. Across China, a program known as Police Cloud allows for the collection and integration of previously unimaginable amounts of information. Who you're in contact with, what you buy, where you travel, when you shop, whether you pay your parking tickets, and so on. A social credit system allows the government to affix a score to someone. How reliable are you? Could you pose a threat of some sort? You live your life with the knowledge that the sum total of your actions could be evaluated by someone, somewhere, with some purpose. This creates incentives and disincentives, given the reach of the party into people's lives. Disincentives are clear. Say the wrong thing, and you could end up detained. But the incentives may be even more powerful. Want a good job? Want your kids to get into a good school? You may have to consider those aspirations with everything you do. When I was in government, Human Rights Watch regularly complained to me about the Obama administration's lack of prioritization of human rights. After I left government, I found myself seeking them out. I connected with Maya Wang, who has a Chinese background herself and has focused her research on technology and authoritarianism within China. The authorities are hoping to use new technologies to build a perfect authoritarian society that is free of dissent or makes dissent irrelevant, she told me, with the idea that the surveillance has a repressive side and a service delivery side. Repression, if you say or think the wrong thing. Service delivery, as technology can anticipate your wants and desires. With more advances in technology, the party is trying to reach a new reality. She summed up the goal this way. We are able to predict dissent before it occurs and crack down on it and completely re-engineer people's identity and thoughts. Just as the party placed a bet after Tiananmen that they could embrace capitalism but not democracy, they're now placing a bet that responding to people's wants and desires in some areas can erase their wants and desires for other things, like politics. This is done by harnessing technologies that are similar to those that help Amazon predict what I might want to buy while nudging me in certain directions. Maya described this as creating the kind of new society where the party serves the people so well that people no longer feel the need for democracy or debate, because we would know you're unhappy about it, or we will manipulate it, so you won't be unhappy about it. This goes far beyond the mixed authoritarianism of Hungary, or the more traditional repression in Russia, where technology can be a tool of surveillance and disinformation, but not achieve total social control. This is a new model of authoritarianism, Maya told me. Almost all authoritarian leaders eventually face the people's desire for freedom. It's a ticking time bomb. The Chinese government is trying to solve that problem, and it seems to be working quite well. Technology is central to the effort to solve that problem. Speaking of the internet, Xi Jinping once said, "Freedom is what order is meant for, and order is the guarantee of freedom." Read that several times and make sense of it. Or think about George Orwell's slogan for the party in 1984, "Freedom is slavery." The most extreme version of Xi's new model of authoritarianism can be seen in China's western Xinjiang Autonomous Region, known as Xinjiang Province, where more than 1 million ethnic and largely Muslim Uyghurs have been detained in camps, and the rest live in a kind of open-air surveillance prison. The Communist Party justifies this as a necessary effort to cleanse the region of radical Islam after a spate of terrorist attacks a few years ago. In reality, the party is trying to reshape Uyghur identity, removing devout Islam and certain cultural traditions while shifting the demographics of the region. Tens of thousands of police have been added. More than 1 million Han Chinese have moved to Xinjiang in recent years, with an untold number staying as guests in Uyghur homes. When you serve in government, you can get numbed to the scale of human suffering in parts of the world. The number of people killed, injured, or detained in a conflict, the quantification of repression in a country, these become numbers and reports, accompanied by the occasional anecdote. You notice over time that certain human suffering also becomes more of a focus of media reporting because of accessible geography or the implication of some easily understood U.S. interest, the danger of terrorism, for instance, or the stability of some U.S.-backed dictator who looks after some important U.S. interests like oil or refugee flows. Americans can become intimately familiar with the suffering, for instance, of several Americans killed by ISIS or refugees trying to reach Europe. If the suffering happens somewhere farther afield, perhaps in some African country divorced from any discernible U.S. interest, the images don't reach us. The suffering is more easily forgotten, chalked up to the vagaries of a cruel world. Over the last few years, the numbers out of Xinjiang came into focus. But because the media faces strict restrictions in this remote part of their country, the picture does not. There would be no images of crying children, separated families, or dead-eyed prisoners. Perhaps some aerial imagery that shows the development of a camp gives us a glimpse of this systematic effort to grind the identity out of a minority group through the relentless application of control. But this would not be something that we would be forced to reckon with through our own eyes. This, too, has been a hallmark of the Communist Party's effort to suggest that such things are not the concern of the wider world. We need not even avert our eyes because there's nothing to see. Why trouble yourself with concern over this place that few people have ever visited or these people whom you have not met? To do so would only complicate things. Complicate China's own valorous efforts to lift people out of poverty. Complicate the business that American companies want to do in China. The Uyghurs are a secondary concern, best left to human rights advocates engaged in a well-meaning but ultimately insignificant business, the complaints of those who don't understand how the world really works. It was reported that Trump himself told Xi that the construction of camps for the Uyghurs was a great idea. Why would he care about some insignificant people he had never met, and whose cause might interfere with his more important work of seeking a trade deal that would require China to purchase more American soybeans? This is the apathy that those with unchecked power seek to engender in others. The idea that it's not even worth caring about something because it's not going to change. That's a strategy the Chinese Communist Party has pursued for decades. For instance, on something like the erasure of the Tibetan people's distinct language, culture, history, and leadership. It would hurt the feelings of the Chinese people and Xi Jinping if you met with the Dalai Lama. It's not worth it, they might as well say. It's not going to change, and we have more important things to talk about. But in Maya Wang's telling, informed by countless interviews with Uyghurs, I didn't interview one person who wasn't crying or close to tears. Xinjiang is really about the future of China. It's about the whole model of Xinjiang, the ability of authorities to put basically an area the size of a third of Western Europe under some kind of lockdown, from prisons to re-education camps to being detained at home, depending on their level of reliability. As I talked to Maya, read her detailed reports of what had taken place in Xinjiang, and scoured the other accounts based on Chinese documentation and Uyghur testimonials, I found myself forced to look more directly at the human circumstance that was unlike anything experienced before. I found myself imagining what it might feel like to be a Uyghur, and what their experience might suggest about the future for other Chinese people, and perhaps for ourselves. There are cameras everywhere, some ostentatiously placed, some invisible. They don't just monitor events, they record your face so as to perfect the facial recognition technologies that make it easier to monitor the population. There are checkpoints everywhere. They don't just stop and question you, they also record images of your face, car, and license plate. You don't know what, exactly, will get you sent to a camp. You can arouse suspicion by being idle or switching jobs. You can be interned for showing religious devotion, attending prayers at the mosque, downloading sermons, covering your hair or growing facial hair, adopting a more pious lifestyle, quitting drinking, for instance. You can be questioned for something that your family members do, including those who live abroad. You have to assume your communications are monitored. You don't know if your phone has been turned into a listening device, your home is surveilled, or your circle of friends is penetrated by informants eager to finger someone as politically questionable, destined for the camps. You can attract attention for knowing too much about what is going on in a place where the authorities only want you to know what they tell you. The curriculum in schools has been changed to sever your children's bonds to what has been a communal identity for generations. You are not permitted to be yourself, to be left alone, and you are presented with no option other than being who the party wants you to be. Technology renders this destiny, quite literally, inevitable. 1 million people in camps. 5 years ago, it would have seemed absurd. Today, it barely registers. Why, having succeeded in doing this in Xinjiang, would the Chinese Communist Party not deploy these methods, export these technologies, and create this dystopia elsewhere? 17. Make China Great Again. We are very early in the period of time through which the world will adjust to China playing a bigger role in our lives, no matter where we live. Yet while the Communist Party's focus on control at home is clear, what the Chinese dream means for the rest of us is not. If you look closely, though, a picture is beginning to come into view. A centerpiece of Xi's global ambitions is the Belt and Road Initiative, a $150 billion per year Chinese-led consortium to build infrastructure involving nearly 70 countries. It started around the time Xi took power, echoing the ancient Silk Road trading route, the age of Marco Polo. Now it has advanced to the point where it is simply one more acronym familiar to government bureaucracies, boardrooms, and readers of The Economist, BRI. If you trace the path of BRI, it begins along China's periphery in Southeast Asia. It snakes through Myanmar, where China is building pipelines and a port in the same province where the Burmese military, which shares a real and manufactured dislike of Muslim minorities and stands to profit off BRI, has ethnically cleansed 1 million Rohingya Muslims. It curves around the Indian Ocean, including Sri Lanka, where a Chinese port can conveniently double as a potential naval facility. From there, BRI reaches into Africa, the colonial competing ground of the pre-World War I European powers. If you put the ports and roads side by side with British ports and roads from 1880, my British friend in Singapore told me, it's the same chart. Geography doesn't change that much. The British didn't mean to become a global hyperpower. They just went out to make some money, and then suddenly they had infrastructure, and then suddenly they were a great power. China has also pushed beyond this geography to places like Hungary, where Viktor Orban signed up for a BRI project, a rail link to Serbia involving a close crony and childhood friend. In this way, if you look at it through the constancy of powerful people seeking profit, the logic of China's expansion is obvious, and no different from that of great powers of the past. The British went abroad for natural resources, built infrastructure to extract and transport those resources, and then began to find new ways to make money by controlling politics in the places where they were dominant. Americans did a version of the same thing in the 20th century, even as we built the kind of international order that could facilitate the rise of a country like China. It is not military power that is the principal source of China's influence. It is money. Corruption can be a lubricant for the effort to ensure that foreign governments are compliant. Sometimes, when we'd be in large bilateral meetings with certain governments, Obama and I would speculate afterward about how many people in the room were being paid in some way by the Chinese government. For smaller, less wealthy countries in particular, this can be completely transactional for China. Pay a bribe to the government, get a foothold of control. One version of this formula is simple. The Chinese use intimidation and bribes to pressure poorer countries to take out huge Chinese loans for infrastructure projects that serve Chinese interests, to extract natural resources, for instance, or to build a road to transport them, often with Chinese labor. Then the countries fall into debt traps where they become beholden to Beijing. Of course, China also prefers to deal with authoritarian governments because it diminishes the danger that democracy will encroach upon China, simplifies the transaction, and makes it less likely that countries will protest when China does things like put 1 million people in camps. So while they are extending their influence, the Chinese Communist Party is also exporting authoritarianism through corruption, geopolitical leverage, and, increasingly, the export of the same technologies that they use to suppress dissent in places like Xinjiang. This creates a particular dilemma for democratic governments. If you seek to isolate authoritarian governments in order to impose some cost for their repression, you only push them further into China's arms. Myanmar, for instance, knows that it will face no sanctions or criticism from China over its treatment of an ethnic Muslim minority group. The international order of laws, rules, norms, and institutions that America has taken the lead in building since the end of World War II is supposed to at least curb excesses, to serve as a check on flagrant abuses of human rights, to impose penalties for the theft of other nations' territory or the intellectual property of companies, to at least discourage corruption and the bullying of smaller countries by bigger ones. But none of it is self-enforcing. As the United States abandoned any investment in that international order under Trump, China ramped up its efforts to create its own new reality through the sheer force of its size and the dogged nature of its actions. They could also easily argue that their authoritarian model was a better choice than the American one, not just for other governments, but for their people as well. As one prominent African entrepreneur put it to me, summing up how billions of people likely feel around the world, I mean, one can argue with China and say, well, China is not democratic. But when you look at the results, hundreds of millions of people brought out of poverty in a very short period of time, one must say, well, okay, how do we learn from the way that has happened? As I traveled the world throughout the Trump years, these two compatible ideas came up again and again. That Chinese authoritarianism might be more effective than American democracy, and that Trump's abandonment of the international order meant that there was no alternative to increasing Chinese influence. In one Asian country, a foreign leader told me that the American-led order is gone, and that China represents the future. When I asked him to explain how China exerts influence, he didn't hesitate to provide an example. Referring to a prospective infrastructure project, he said that in the past, the government would have considered bids from Europe, Japan, and China. The decision could have been informed by everything from cost to quality to reputation to considerations of geopolitics. Now, he said, we know it has to be the Chinese bid. To cross China is not worth the risk. Ultimately, this shift in the center of the world's gravity doesn't just shape particular transactions and policies. It begins to shift how we behave, in a version of how a totalitarian government exerts control over the behavior of its citizens. For rich countries, big corporations, and prominent individuals who want access to Chinese markets or investments, there is increasingly an explicit cost and return. Do not meet with people like the Dalai Lama. do not oppose China's position on matters like the South China Sea. Do not investigate or even inquire about what is happening in Xinjiang. Do not comment on anything